Friends, this podcast was sponsored by the Flow Living Hormone Center at flowliving.com, your one-stop concierge for your period where you can test, track, treat, and talk about putting your period issues into remission naturally from anywhere in the world. And the MyFlow app, which you can find at myflowtracker.com, which is the only cycle syncing app that lets you use your hormones to master your life. And by the Balance Supplement Period Box. Whether you're on the pill or not, your hormones need specific micronutrients to stay healthy. Balance by Flow Living is the first and only supplement subscription box to biohack your period. Sounds pretty good to us. Want to learn more dope things about your body? Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Cycles and Sex. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for coming out here, and I'm really excited to get started. I guess we'll start with Liz, because you're sitting next to me. Liz, so we know about the benefits of masturbation, but Lioness has sensors that measure arousal and states your orgasm patterns. How does that work, and what are some things we can learn from that data, and why would we even want to track our orgasms?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. So I actually brought a sample here. So this is our vibrator. And so basically how it works is that there are sensors inside this vibrator where after you use it, you can sync it to an app and you can see your own body's sexual response, including your orgasm. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I love it. And so basically, let's see, breaking down like in terms of like what is this exactly? So what you're looking at is, you're looking at the changes, at least for this chart, you're looking at the changes of the pelvic floor movement over time. And a big indicator of orgasm a lot of times is a specific pattern of pelvic floor movements that you will have that indicates an orgasm. And so what do you do with that information? Why do I want to like know more about orgasms in this way? Well, everyone is different. We all know that. And it turns out everyone experiences pleasure in a different way, where one of the things that we found early on, where we've been starting to replicate some of the research that's been done in the, like, around starting 1980s or so, is that there's different people, for instance, have different patterns of orgasm, so different patterns of pelvic floor movements that indicate an orgasm. And that just leads into a whole ton of different questions of, like, How are those different? You have some that are kind of like ocean waves where the pelvic floor is just rhythmically moving, whereas you have something that we call more of a volcanic response where it's one, like kind of like a buildup of the pelvic floor and then a gradual relaxation, kind of shaping there other way. So these are literally different experiences that different people are having. So for one, if you read a book or watch a movie and you're like, huh, like that experience seems different than mine. Like, what's going on here? It could literally mean that that person or that description is a different experience than what you're having. And that's cool because, like, they have their experience. You have your experience. Orgasms are both great. Both of them.
Absolutely.
And then the other part of it, too, is it leads into all the other different questions of how does a person become more aroused, what do those patterns look like? What works for one person versus another person? And we can start getting a sense of, all right, so these sort of things work for this person versus these set of different things work for another person. And finally, figure out a way to personalize our experiences and improve and explore.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing some information about the product. Something that comes up when we're talking about teledildonics or like, or toys that really rely heavily on technology and incorporate technology into this kind of intimate experience is how is technology changing our experience of intimacy? And I kind of wanted to hear some of your thoughts about that. Like, mm-hmm. how can a product like your Vibe enhance intimacy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think fact of the matter is for all technology, like, I was thinking, like, even like with TVs, like televisions, it has benefits and it has drawbacks, you know, where it's like TV, like we are glued to the TV a lot and like parents are worried about kids watching too much TV and their brains becoming kind of mushy, you know? And it's a similar thing with like vibrators and intimacy and sexuality, where technology can be used for good or for bad. And that's kind of, you know, an inevitable thing. In terms of, like, we're trying to be for good, and it's particularly good for women to help them, to help women learn more about their own bodies, or even just anybody who's curious to try it, and also people who are, like, with their partners and stuff like that, too. And our thing is, the data, it's not really so much for, like, data for data's sake. It's data for, like, learning and for communication and for exploring. So, like, you have this sort of, like, app, and you're like, all right, so what do I do with this? And what we've had early on with just feedback from people who have been early buyers is I'm able to, like, sit down with my partner and point out, this is my orgasm. This is my orgasm over time. This is what it looks like. This is what it's like. And then start having some of these conversations that they may have not had quite in the same way as before, where it's sort of this abstract, like, I'm talking about an orgasm, and it's almost like trying to talk about the color blue. It's like you can kind of point at the color blue. You can say, oh, that's blue, and then you're like, yeah, the other person's like, yeah, that's blue. But you can't, the conversation sort of stops there. Whereas, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting because, like, the majority of the work that we do at the Pleasure Chest is, like, really kind of trying to connect people on how to, help support them in how to communicate about orgasms or about desire or about physical experience. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of folks, it does feel kind of elusive or abstract. And so to have, like, hard data for folks who are kind of wired that way seems pretty, like, an amazing tool for communication and building intimacy.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, the other thing too with that is related case. We were at the Mothership Festival recently, which is it was like this retreat over in near Palm Springs, and it was mostly like women inclusively who were there. And one of the things that was really cool from that experience was we had people were able to try the Lioness while they were there. And we got to talk about their orgasm pattern and get basically feedback from them too at the same time. And as I was going back and forth from like the porta potties at night, it's like it's a campsite, it's totally dark, just like stumbling around. I'm hearing these conversations from people who are like, oh, I'm a volcano type, or I'm an avalanche, or I'm an ocean wave. And it's like, what's your experience like? And it's so cool because it's like you're not just talking about orgasm and like it's like, what about orgasm or what about pleasure or what about these different things? But you're able to start talking about some of these nuances of like, you felt this way, I felt that way. What is that way like? What is my way like? And it's like moving the conversation forward and helping people understand like everything and like not only just themselves, since they kind of know themselves, but themselves in context too of like all the different experiences of pleasure that could be possible.
Yeah, great, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So that actually, like, I was thinking about how we're framing this conversation to be around sex taboos, and I was thinking a lot about, like, okay, how does this particular this particular technology connect to the topic of sex taboos? And I think a lot of it is just that idea of, like, really understanding that experiences of pleasure and orgasm are just going to vary so deeply. And part of where we get stuck with creating taboos or like kind of getting stuck in taboos is like oftentimes people think there's one experience and there's one way to have a body and one way to be sexual. Mm-hmm. So I think that the technologies that you're introducing are super groundbreaking in that. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, I hope so. Thank you.
Great. So, Whitney, I would love to hear more about your I Didn't Ask for This, A Lifetime of Dick Pics project, and just sort of how it started, what you want people to know, and how does it relate to the current, like, hashtag Me Too, like, folks just really showing up publicly and sharing their stories around assault and violence.
Well, it's super relevant right now. The show's been going on for about a year and a half. We've gone to 3 cities, and we're about to embark on a 5-city international tour, which is really exciting. I'll give you a little information about it. It is 200 unsolicited dick pics and the oftentimes really aggressive messages that accompany them, displayed in a full recreation of a woman's home, bedroom, bathroom, living room, kitchen, office, because I wanted the viewer to feel innately at home and really comfortable, because that's the way that we all experience sexual harassment and assault is you're living your life, you're walking your dog, you get catcalled on the street, you are in bed and you get a dick pic. Whatever form of harassment that comes in, it is interjected into your life in a way that you should feel safe. And I wanted to do that because it opens up a conversation about how this isn't normal, how we all treat harassment, especially against women, as par for the course. This is something we're just expected to experience. It's not new, it's not frustrating, and I wanted to show that it's not normal at all. And the show's popularity has been really incredible, but with that popularity has come a massive amount of vitriol and hatred and reactionary harassment, which is not surprising to me in the least. I have been called every disgusting name that exists. A group of activists tried to get the show shut down claiming revenge porn, which it's not, and I don't have that much time, so I'm not going to list all the legal reasons why it's not, but I had to prove that in a court case in San Francisco. You know, I'm not surprised that calling out harassment has met me with floodgates of harassment I never even knew I could experience. And with the hashtag MeToo situation that is so prevalent right now, what I find really troubling is that we're all almost becoming numb to it. It's been, what, a week and a half and 2 weeks maybe, and so many women, men, and queer folks have come forward with their stories of harassment and sexual abuse. And the mass media has marketed it to us in a way that it's just been this insane avalanche, and we're all supposed to, what, be surprised? I wasn't surprised. I don't think, were any of you surprised? No? We have to live this way every day. The only people who really did seem surprised to me are cis hetero men who don't experience this. I was actually just talking to Chris earlier, and he was telling me when he first heard about my show, he was like, you know, I was angry. It made me mad. I felt, you know, like a little bit victimized. And he obviously turned around, and he's a smart man who became introspective and thought about why he had that reaction. But that's the reaction I get from most men. Or it's the opposite. It's, well, I don't do that. I've never sent a dick pic, so I'm not part of the problem. Instead of listening to what I'm saying and listening to the fact that this is an overwhelming issue and that it's not just about the dick pics, it's about the sexual harassment that we face every single day as women. It's about the sexual abuse that we're just supposed to sweep under the rug and not talk about. And Me Too has been fantastic because we all are starting to finally, you know, share our stories, and I don't want to downplay the importance of that. But at the same time, you know, writing hashtag Me Too on an Instagram post really isn't going to change that much. It might feel good for a brief second to come forward, but until we start having these conversations in real life, with each other, and not just screaming into our own echo chamber of feminism and the women who also have experienced this. We need to talk to the men in our lives, and we need to tell them how much of a problem this is every single day. And it's not just that time that you were raped. It's the abuse and the harassment that you experience always. And I feel like I didn't hear that conversation happening a lot, so I wanted to create an actual physical safe space where women and femmes and allies could come together and have these discussions. And we sort of, like this event, added a full day of panels to discuss intersectionality and the intersection of feminism and pornography, sexual abuse in the digital era, all kinds of things. And we want to just continue to bust that open and have more of these conversations and discuss the ways that race and gender and, you know, all play into our compounding harassment.
Thank you.
I think the conversation of like what happens like next now. So we have people like testifying and witnessing each other, right? So what happens next? Like, where are we? How are we creating that cultural shift that like is really influencing folks who are like socialized with the power to like be continuously inflicting violence, right? Like, how do we interrupt that? That's the next part of the conversation. And I hope that that's something that we can continue to talk about here and in like our everyday work and in all of the work that we do. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what was disappointing for me is that I think work like what you're doing often is represented or perceived as for women. And I think as a cis male, it's actually more accurately directed towards us. And it's such a powerful intervention to have to come in contact with that level of harassment that in no other form would I ever have to encounter. And so as like a cis male, you know, sexual assault plays barely any role in my life. And so seeing work like yours was so profound, but unfortunately most men do not think that it is work for them and they miss out on that intervention. So, you know, I guess I use then my privilege to try to pull men into that conversation because sexual assault's a male issue.
That's exactly right, Chris. Sexual assault is a man's issue, not a woman's issue. And I don't want to say that women cannot be perpetrators of sexual assault or harassment or that queer people cannot be. Of course they can be. No one was saying otherwise. But there is an overwhelming majority of male-on-female violence. We cannot dispute that fact. And we have a toxic masculinity problem, and we're all complicit in it. We have built masculinity around an idea that they are innately deserving of sexual satisfaction. And then we, as the media or as all of us, are complicit in adding like aggression into being one of the like touting principles of masculinity. And so when you combine those two things, of course we have this problem. Of course men feel entitled to this, but that's doing no one any good. It pigeonholes men and tells them that they aren't responsible for their actions, that boys will be boys, and that that's just the way it is. But feminism holds that men are better than that, that men are more complex than that, and I think that's true. I think that the conversations that we have around this gender binary are harmful to everyone, and it's time for men to start accepting that too, and that feminism is not for women, that sexual assault is not our problem, it's everyone's problem.
So Whitney, just to kind of follow up on that, like you just said something that was that kind of stood out, where you said like men are socialized to like expect like sexual, I don't remember exactly what you said, but sexual satisfaction. And that's something that I think about a lot also, like how are we developing and connecting to our own sexual desire outside of the male gaze? Even for folks who are who are not in relationships or relating sexually to like cishet men, like how are we kind of moving away from that, and how do we find a sexuality that's empowering? Like, what are some ways to feel empowered in our sexuality and our desire? And I kind of wanted to like pose that to you, like how do you frame that?
I mean, that's a really fascinating question. I think that it's really difficult, and I'm not going to say that that's something I also haven't struggled with. I am bisexual, but I have mostly dated men, and I feel like I cater sometimes often shamelessly to that, and it's not even a conscious decision. It's through the social media that I post, it's through the outfits that I wear every day, because we've all been societally conditioned to put on heels to lift our buttocks, to wear bras to lift our breasts, and all of that has been done under this patriarchal lens. And I think that it's the only way to move past that is through conversation, like we've said about everything, even with, you know, with your masturbation stuff. The only way to unlearn these preconceived notions that we have all been, that have been like societally inflicted upon us, is to discuss them and is to do like Chris did, and is to break down like, well, why am I having this reaction? Why am I acting in this way? Why am I wearing this thing? And to constantly question ourselves and to wonder, is this coming from my true self, or is this coming from the patriarchal capitalistic ideas that have been shoved on me my entire life? And we just have to keep checking ourselves and checking those around us.
Great. Thank you so much. Elle, I'm really, really excited to hear more about your work. Particularly, your work focuses on body acceptance and body positivity, and I want to hear a little bit more about how body acceptance is connected to pleasure?
That's a good question. I believe that body acceptance and sexual pleasure are inextricably linked. I think when we are not accepting of our bodies, that we are thinking about what our bodies look like constantly while we're having sex with whoever we're having sex with. When we accept our bodies, and let me just say, we don't have to love our bodies. That is sort of, in my opinion, a bigger journey. But if we can accept what our bodies look like right now, we're much more able to be in the moment with our partners and be able to focus on the pleasure that you're giving them and that they're giving you, and be really mindful of that.
Yeah, and I guess the second part is I wanted to touch a little bit on your work as an educator. You have such a broad platform and you're connecting with so many different audiences. And we've been talking so much, and there's such a deep focus on sexual assault and sexual harassment in the media. And I kind of wanted to get your take on, as a sex educator, how are you centering talking about consent in your work? And also, like, for folks who are survivors, like, how do you talk about for those folks in your workshops, like embracing trauma or healing from trauma? Because I know that you do some of that in your work, so I wanted to hear a little bit more about it.
Thank you. I think with consent, it's a complex issue, right? I think that there are people that violate consent and people that violate consent and people that know that they violate consent, and people who violate consent and they're like, wait, what? I violated consent. I think as sex educators, we need to be really mindful of integrating lessons on consent into sex education on a whole. Like, I'll teach a blowjob class on how to give a good blowjob.
Yeah.
And yet I will also put lessons in there about consent, so that when they leave, not only are they getting sex tips, but they're also leaving with some information that maybe they don't have. I think we all know that sex education for teenagers is broken in this society. And teenagers take what they know about consent and what they know about sex, and they bring that into adulthood. So when we're teaching adults sex education, we have to be really mindful of that and teach them what consent is and what it isn't in order to get the point across. As far as sexual assault goes and teaching about sex and being able to help them heal from it and enjoy sex, I think that as sex educators, if we don't assume that there's at least one person in the room that is a survivor of sexual assault or abuse, harassment, then we're not doing our job and we're deluding ourselves, because we know the stats, right? It's a hard one. What I like to do when I'm talking to a survivor is really let them know that there's no one way to access pleasure, that it's not a universal experience. Sexual pleasure is informed by our desire, by our trauma, by body image issues, by our identity. And so it's a many sort of sided die for those Dungeons and Dragons fans there. I think also letting them know that they're not broken, they're not ruined, that I hear them, I believe them, I support them, I encourage them to go on their sexual journey at their own pace and not judge themselves, because it's a really challenging road to hoe. You need to be gentle with yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And Elle, can you tell us a little bit more about Curvy Girl Sex?
Why, I'd love to, Victor. Curvy Girl Sex is mostly 101 body positive positions to enhance your sex life. And it does say curvy girl, but it really is meant for men, for non-binary people, for transgender people. All of the positions are good for that. I also talk a lot about body positivity and about sexual health so that when you're going through the positions, you can sort of understand where the clit is and know what parts of the penis are really, really awesome to touch and lick and do whatever. So that's sort of a little bit about Curvy Girl Sex.
If you guys are, if anyone's interested in seeing Curvy Girl Sex, we do have copies of it in the Pleasure Chest pop-up, so stop by and take a look. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I did really want to quickly say something, jumping off what you were talking about sexual assault and being compassionate to survivors, and just talk about the binary that we place on that, even this victim versus survivor mentality. And it's even outlined on the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network website, the difference between these two stages. And we force any victim or survivor into these boxes. And I feel like, as one myself, I never felt like one or the other. I felt like both all the time. And I think I'll continue to feel like both all the time. And it's just another binary that we place unnecessarily on people, that you have to define your healing, and that's not the way that healing works.
Thank you. Thanks. So Chris, your book is called Sex Outside the Lines and Authentic Sexuality in a Sexually Dysfunctional Culture. Can you tell us a little bit more about these lines and why you consider our culture sexually dysfunctional?
Sure. 200 pages down to one sentence.
Yeah.
So I guess the way I like to frame it is, when I was getting clinically trained in traditional psychology, I also unfortunately fell into some early training in the sex addiction world and the sex addiction model. And what was really powerful for me was that I was leading a very healthy life. I had amazing healthy friends. And the kind of relational styles and sex that we were having was being openly pathologized in my psychology training, in my master's and doctoral program, and also within the sex addiction world. So I was clinically being supervised and educated to pathologize, like I said earlier, forms of sexuality and relationality that me and the people in my life were engaging in. And it was heartbreaking. And I was seeing how we were traumatizing. And I really believe that the work of therapy should be one of healing and liberation. So that's become my mission clinically, is to really critically analyze the norms and the values that we have within the field of mental health, because those are what trickle down and that the media refer to. Television refers to that. Writers refer to that. And it's highly problematic. And one of the things I try to remind people is that a difference is not a disorder. In fact, difference is health. And I try to even use examples of how queer nature is as a way to battle this idea of what's normal and what's natural. You know, nature is so fucking queer. There's polyamory, there's non-monogamy, there's homosexuality, there's transsexuality, there's non-genderism, there's forms of birth control, there's anal sex, and we're really afraid of that. And one of the biggest questions that comes into my office is, am I normal? Almost everything that comes to my office clinically, working as a sex therapist, is, am I normal? And I tell people, that's not the goal. And being different is actually a beautiful, creative strength. And so I'm trying to push the field into neurodiversity, disability studies, queer theory. And so I really work with my clients on not only feeling confident, living and being sexual outside the lines being, you know, male, cis, hetero, thin, intercourse, penetratively focused sex, and not only get them comfortable living outside of that, but actually pushing them outside of that. I walk my clients into kinks. I help them try to find those creative, diverse parts of who they are, because if you can't accept yourself and your sexual totality, I don't believe you can move through the world feeling very confident out in the world. And I really call attention to media. Media and social media is the number one socializer we have. When a client comes into my office and they say, I hate my body, I say, let's look at the social media you follow. And if you're looking at things that make you feel bad about who you are and don't reflect back who you are, how you look, and how you want to be, unfollow that shit, right? And I did that on my own, and it was so powerful and transformative to really, you know, immerse my psyche, because our brains and our psyche and our self-esteem are constructed by what we embed ourselves in. And so I had to look at the people I spent time around, the conversations I allow them to have around me. My social media is just queer, feminist, body positive stuff, because that's the way I want to think. That's how I want to move through the world.
You mentioned your work with clients. And when we were coming up with questions, we were wondering, like, okay, are there in your work, do you see like there are particular trends of like things that come up over and over again that people consider taboo or consider dysfunctional within their own sexuality?
Yeah, it's the year of anal, which is amazing. That's when the number one questions. I do a podcast weekly, Loveline, and I swear anal comes up almost every podcast. Like, how do I, should I, can I? Sadly and happily, because we can have a conversation around it, it also bumps into, is my boyfriend or male-identified partner gay if he wants his ass played with or has? So there's a lot of biphobia still around males and bi erasure. Year of anal, as I said, but again, sex addiction, it has a grip on our culture, and it's not real, and it's a miseducation around what healthy sex looks like. And, you know, we're moving into fourth wave feminism, body positive, sex positive, technological, pro porn. I prescribe porn in many therapeutic healing ways to show body diversity, sexual diversity. There's feminist queer porn. So still a lot of porn phobia. People wanting to also try different relational styles. But again, our media and culture really has people afraid of masturbation, pornography, body diversity. But on the positive end, yeah, it's like the year of anal. I'm trying to get all the male-identified people in my office to be getting into the anal.
That's awesome.
Like, you all are missing out. It's revolutionary.
Well, you can send them our way for any toys they might need or any advice. All right. So Sarah, I actually got a chance to take a look at Flex's website last night and was like, oh, this is a product that I'm familiar with from previous iterations in personal use and that I love. So I'm so glad that you are here so that I can tell you that I love this product.
Awesome.
But also, something that stands out is when you go to Flex's website, right on the homepage, like one of the first things you see is that Flex is great for wearing during period sex. How does the cycle play into sex and pleasure, and how and why is it important to have that on the front page of your website?
So Flex is a period product. It replaces cups or tampons. It's disposable, body safe, and it sits around the cervix, which is the widest part of the vaginal canal. It's also less sensitive, so if you experience discomfort from cups or tampons, it sits in a different place. And that's why you can have period sex on it, because the vaginal canal is clear. You can put whatever fun things you want to put in there because there's nothing blocking your way. And you don't have to stain your sheets or your toys. So your question is, how does sex play into the cycle? I think that, you know, I've had people ask me, is it normal to have sex on your period or to want to have sex on your period? And I think that we can look at sexuality and bodies as either this. Sometimes it gets divided into these studies, biological numbers, or it can be the psychology and the setting and the mood, but it's really always a combination of both. So wanting to have sex in your period is just as normal and natural as any other time. It's great hearing from people that they're like, oh, you know, I love having sex in my period. It makes my periods shorter. It alleviates cramping for some people having an orgasm. We're just happy to have a product that can do that.
Awesome. And can you tell us a little bit about, like, have you heard of folks incorporating period blood into their sexuality and sex activity?
Yeah, I mean, period blood is obviously a natural lubricant. You know, it's pretty slick. So that's always pretty much the go-to thing. Sometimes people wonder, because of Flex, there's some misinformation out there. Because it sits around the cervix, it collects menses, but vaginal lubrication happens in the lower part of the vaginal canal, like the lower third. So people say sometimes, if I'm using Flex, will I not be able to, will all my lubrication be caught in the Flex sticks? And the answer is no. So they are separate, but yeah.
Great. Something that I we've been learning a lot about recently is just like the relationship between tampons and like increased dryness and microabrasions, and actually like how tampons can be make you more susceptible to infection and irritation during penetration. So it's really great to have that alternative, and also to be like kind of pushing the conversation so that folks are thinking about like instead of the cycle being a thing that you don't talk about, or like sex during your cycle being taboo, actually like embracing the way that like our cycles can be part of our sexuality and how to make it comfortable and safe. And thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have one big question for everyone. What are some taboos that you think your work is pushing or that folks bring to you, and how do you encourage folks to break their own taboos?
I have an answer immediately for that. Only because it's so personal, and doing a podcast, you get a lot of calls, so I get like a big data set of what's kind of going on. And I at one point in my life, I ran in a community of like, I guess, male attracted to male, gay identified, and now I very much run in a queer, more fluid, bisexual space, because that's how I identify and that's where I'm comfortable. But what's really interesting is in talking to men that have sex with men that also incorporate female presenting bodies into their sexuality, there's a struggle for them to understand the possible fluidity or bisexuality of that, whether watching heterosexual identified porn or even for some of them trans porn, and just understanding that they actually have a more diverse creative sexuality than they've been led to believe. Because as we're talking about labels and categories, they can really trap us, and people get very comfortable within those. And so I've been watching and trying to push through, because it was transformative for me, this idea that your sexuality is probably more diverse and creative than you think.
Yeah.
And don't get trapped in just looking at the one gender. Take note of all the other things around there, because a lot of the gay community is actually far more bi than they realize. Because mm-hmm. bisexuality can be 90% male, 10% female, still bi. 99% female, 1% male, still bi. And I think that, again, bi identity, we did a huge study and it said that like of the millennials, 54 to 56% identified as non-hetero. So we're already moving in that direction. So I've been trying to kind of push people to kind of bring that forward.
Yeah, and something that you said just like sparked for me that when folks say like I'm attracted to one gender, right, or like they have an understanding of like what the relationship means, like whether it heterosexualizes it or queers it or whatever, like if it, how it affects your own sexual orientation, right? I first of all, like, you know, your orientation is your orientation, and whatever you bring into your sexual interactions, like that's what you bring, and no one sexual interaction defines your sexual orientation. But also we all inhabit our genders completely differently. So like, and we all inhabit our bodies completely differently, and we all experience pleasure completely differently. So there isn't really a rigid way of defining like this is the way that being straight looks like, this is the way that being queer if you're of this gender or have this set of genitals looks like, or et cetera. So yeah.
I guess with my work, the biggest thing that I do is try to encourage discussion about topics that often go undiscussed, and our personal experiences with harassment and assault, but not just, again, like I said before, with each other, but with, you know, the cis dudes in our lives. And I wrote a piece for Playboy about consent, and it was all packaged in a very cutesy sort of, I had to cater a little bit to some patriarchal norms to get them to listen to me. And I got a lot of flack from people saying, oh, well, you're a feminist, but you're writing for Playboy, and how, you know, how can you do this? But until we break down some of these barriers that are dividing us, and until we reach across party lines and stop screaming into our own echo chambers, we're never going to see any real change if we're just talking to each other. And so I feel like the taboos that I'm trying to break down are the ways that we have these discussions and conversations, and the ways that we formulate them to each other. And yes, my editors did take out like the word patriarchy from this article, which pissed me off. But at the same time, like, if that's what I have to do to get these Playboy reading dudes to hear my message, then like, yeah, I'm gonna do it. And did I make my like author profile pic like show a little nipple? Like, yes, I did. And am I super proud of that? No, but it got a lot of these dudes like following me on Instagram. So then they hear me every single day. And that's, you know, that's a personal sacrifice I had to make, but we have to start doing that in order to have real conversations, and that moves into the political sphere and the great divide that our country's in right now.
Yeah, and that's so interesting what you just said about, like, talking to folks who are, like, in this, like, kind of more mainstream or traditional arena, right? Because oftentimes when we think about, like, when we're framing things in terms of taboos, we think of things that are, like, outside of the mainstream, but, like, the taboo that you're describing is, like, actually reaching out into that broader audience and, like, and connecting with folks and challenging those norms. So that's a really cool, interesting way of thinking about it.
Hi.
Hi.
I have actually, I think there are two ways that I at least try to break down norms. And one of them is obviously body positivity and body acceptance. I try and make people feel that it is actually something that's easier to reach for, body acceptance, and that we all deserve sexual pleasure in this body right now. And that is something I feel really passionately about, but I also have a porn site, LadyCheeky.com. And I started the porn site because I was in a sexually repressed marriage and I didn't know what I liked. And so I found images that I liked and I just posted them. And it really helped me find my sexual self. It really helped me look at different kinds of sexuality and go, I think I might want to try that. Oh, I'm actually attracted to that person. And so for everyone that talks about porn addiction or talks about porn in a negative way, there are so many ways that porn can be fruitful for everyone if you look at it in a certain way.
Totally, yeah.
One of the unexpected ways that I'm talking about, like, you know, addressing taboos with people who reach out to the Flex company are parents, actually. A lot of moms and dads will call and say, I'm really afraid my kid's going to get TSS. I don't like, but they're not responsible enough to take care of a cup. Can we, you know, is your product safe for them? And I will have conversations with kids being like, I want to talk to my mom about getting this, but I'm scared. It was kind of an unexpected, you know, result of just putting this product out there that I end up talking to parents and children, our young teens, a lot. And that's probably one of my favorite taboos to kind of bust is having parents and kids have a dialogue about sexuality and, you know, reproductive health. So that's my favorite, yeah. Yeah, clap for her.
And thinking like, yeah, in terms of Linus, it's like, where do we start with in terms of breaking taboos? But two of my favorites are, well, kind of summed up into one is having people actually think about masturbation and about pleasure and talk about masturbation and pleasure in ways that they may have not, like, thought about or may have not been able to because they may have not had the words for it to describe it. And one of the things from one woman who was an early buyer, and she started testing out some of the stuff that her doctor was recommending because she had been struggling with experiencing pleasure. She wasn't getting to orgasm as much as she had wanted to and she had hopes. And she was like, okay, so the doctor said, maybe take a, you know, have a glass of wine before masturbating and let's see what happens. And so she compared that to not having a glass of wine before masturbating. And she was actually finding that it was taking her longer, like the more that she drank, versus when she didn't drink at all. And she's like, wait a second, like this, like, you know, not only did it seem kind of like off-putting from her doctor to tell her this, but also it's like, it didn't work for her. So she should be trying something else. So that was one thing where it was like, okay, I can actually see like what's going on and how different things work with my body or different scenarios work with me over time. And then the other side of it too, in terms of talking about masturbation, we have a group of folks, women who are like in their 40s, 50s, and well, I'll just say in the U.S. One of my favorite stories from one of them was she learned about Linus from one of her friends, and it was like over sort of like a coffee sort of thing, and they all decided to buy the Linus, like each of them buy a Linus, so they could try it, and then they'd go and get drinks later and talk about their experiences. And it's like these women in the, basically in like the middle of the United States, like talking about this, which like someone in the coast might be like, huh, people are talking about masturbation in Nebraska, or, you know, something like that. It's like, yeah, they are. Like, humans are kind of interested in sex and pleasure and masturbation. And the best part was she said that they're basically having this, like, they call it a book club.
That's
but
awesome.
It's, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's like a book club, but much more interesting. Like, they're actually, like, following it and, like, meeting up and talking about it instead of just, like, a book club where you're just having drinks. It's a book club where you're having drinks and you're talking about orgasms. It's great.
It's amazing. Thank you so much, everyone, for participating in the panel. I am so excited to, like, keep learning more about all of your work and to catch you guys around. And please stop by the Pleasure Chest pop-up. I'm going to be teaching a sensation play workshop now. So come check me out.
Thanks for hosting.
Hi, friends. Just a reminder that we need to give big props to Elisa Vitti of the Flow Living Hormone Center at flowliving.com, MyFlow app, myflowtracker.com, and Balance by Flow, the Balance Supplement Period Box, for sponsoring these podcasts. So check out her work, and don't forget to follow us on Instagram @cyclesandsex to learn more dope things about your body.